of the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. Every year, Medical Defence Organisation MDA National sponsors a $10,000 prize for excellence in medical research for the best research published in the MJA in the previous calendar year. This year, the prize goes to a truly world-class piece of research, which has made a difference globally in the fight against COVID-19. The authors, all from the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne, were the first to isolate the SARS-CoV-2 virus outside China and subsequently shared their work with the world within 24 hours of successfully growing the virus in their lab. The study, called Isolation and Rapid Sharing of the 2019 Novel Coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 from the First Patient Diagnosed with COVID-19 in Australia, is available at mja.com.au and is free to access. Today, my guests are three of the study's co-authors, Dr. Mike Catton, Deputy Director of the Doherty and Head of the Institute's Victorian Infectious Diseases Reference Library, Dr. Julian Druce, Head of the Virus Identification Laboratory at the Doherty, and Dr. Leon Cayley, a Senior Medical Scientist in the Virus Identification Laboratory and the man who did the sequencing. Thanks all for joining me, and congratulations on winning the MDA National Prize for Medical Research Excellence.
Yeah, look, thanks very much. Extremely proud of this, and would like to thank both the MJA and the AMA and the sponsor MDA National for this prestigious award, which I guess I'm accepting on behalf of the team. It's a big group. Pathology and related research is a team sport, not an individual activity.
Julian, something happened 12 or 13 years ago at the Doherty which set you guys up to be perfectly positioned for when the COVID-19 pandemic became an international thing.
We've always had a long-standing interest in virus discovery and finding new answers to problems. As the virology as a pathology moved into the PCR or pathology relevant era. And so in 2007, we had this unusual transplant cluster in Melbourne. Unfortunately, three women all died following transplant. And we managed to investigate this with a team that was also based in the US. And this used what was at the time a new technology called whole genome sequencing. And that ended up at that time taking about 3 to 4 months. And so to discover something new or for it to take that long was too long in the relevance of something that was acutely required, say in a pandemic outbreak such as this. And so we endeavored to include in our toolbox another set of elements or tests that we could apply very quickly to potentially discover a new agent or a new virus that was spreading in the community in such an event. And that was a whole lot of molecular tests that have kind of not specific to any one virus, but to a group or family of viruses. And so this method really employed existing technologies that we had, but detuned it so that we could really cast the net very wide. And the output from that test doesn't give you a defined answer as to what you've got, but then when you do genetic sequencing of the material that you derive from that test, it gives you such an answer. And so at that time, you know, in 2008-09, we designed a whole raft of tests, one of which was a pan coronavirus PCR, which has the capacity to detect any coronavirus, whether it be animal or human. And so that's been sitting in the cupboard or the freezer for many, many years.
Was part of that triggered by what was going on with SARS and MERS around the country at that time?
It was linked into any of our outbreak response capacity. And curiously, you mentioned MERS, and that emerged after the design of this test. And so that was the perfect opportunity to assess that this test did indeed work for a newly emerging pathogen. So we were confident that it would work into the future. And that test time or opportunity came around at the beginning of last year.
And to pick up on what you were saying, our lab had played a leading role back in 2003 and 2005, just in Australia's national preparedness for both SARS and bird flu. As it happened, we didn't have cases, but you know, in the back room, a lot of this work is done just in case. So yeah,
fantastic.
We were involved in it.
19th of January last year, 2020, a man arrives from China, is admitted to hospital on the 24th, and Were you involved before or after he was admitted? I mean, when did you guys first hear about this case, and how did you become involved?
We'd been testing through the preceding couple of weeks returned travellers from Wuhan, and he wasn't the first. But so his sample was referred to us from Monash Medical Center, where he'd been admitted as one of those tests on that Friday before the Australia Day long weekend. So that's the point at which we became involved. The infectious diseases team at Monash referring a sample to over to us for testing.
So when had you first heard about what was going on in China?
31st of December. We all, Mike, myself and Leon, all get ProMed reports, which are little posts that indicate something's happening globally for various viruses or unknown elements. And so we were aware of pneumonia of unknown origin occurring in Wuhan on that date. And as Mike indicated, we were involved in SARS-1 in 2003, and that was exactly the same post that occurred at that time. It kind of instantly, we just looked at each other and thought, a coronavirus. Time of year, same scenario.
In the time from the 31st of December until you got your hands on a sample, what were you doing? What were you thinking? How are you preparing?
Yeah, so initially it was all just, well, what's going on? WHO did reach out and contact us early in January, I think it was the 5th, asking if we had a pan-coronavirus test, which is the test I mentioned earlier, which we did. And so then we were kind of looped in or linked in to high-level discussions at that point, which started literally that weekend after that. And we got access to a whole genome sequencing that was released by Eddie Holmes. And Leon quickly mapped that sequence to our existing primers just to assess that there were no genetic divergences or differences to see if that test would work. And then maybe Leon can elaborate on that. You quickly also aligned our existing seasonal corona test to see if to quickly adapt it to be a specific test for this new virus.
Yes, so we've got multiple tests. So the test that Julian's mentioning, the pan corona, is usually a test that takes the whole day. But we do have a rapid test, which is a TACMAN PCR, and that can be completed once you have your RNA within an hour and a half. And so I compared our existing coronavirus TACMAN assay to the sequence of what was known as SARS-CoV-2 now, and there was a few little mutations in there. And so I tweaked that assay, and within 24 hours we had new primers delivered here. So we had the assay ready to go for when it eventually hit us.
Fantastic. Apart from the public health sense of urgency, you know, how many people can we help, how quickly, is there also a sense of competition around the world between various institutes around the world? Is there a race on?
A little bit, but it's mainly public good focused at that point. You know, I mean, later on, I guess you get academic competition, but at that early point, the people that are involved are generally people like our lab, people whose task is to protect the community, and is usually a sense of a common objective and a common enemy, if you like.
Had China released any data at that point?
The Chinese released some information on the 11th of January, where Mike and myself were involved in some WHO conference calls, and that was at that time really around clinical cases associated with the wet market in Wuhan, yep. Of which there was about 40 cases at that time, and I think from memory about 30 of them had a close contact with that market. There were no deaths at that time, and so at that point in time, as much as there was concern, there wasn't huge alarm because there had not yet been case fatalities.
Early on, it sounded like a point source outbreak. There was the strong connection with the market. There was explicitly no human-to-human transmission. That was what the official information from China was, and no deaths. So it sounded like, and we remarked on the resemblance to SARS-1, but it sounded like something to be alert but not alarmed about. So we were preparing our capacity really just in case, to be prepared just like we had with SARS-1. And it was only really through the early days of January that the information started to move in the direction of greater concern. And I think the point was where I think Julian texted me or said something like iceberg was, iceberg was when there was the first case in Thailand. And we thought, we've got international spread, we've got human-to-human transmission here. This is not not something that's simple, and we need to be concerned about it.
So what distinguished this coronavirus from the others that you'd seen?
So in terms of recent history, like the last 20 years, we've had three coronaviruses emerge. SARS-1, which was obviously its name, severe acute respiratory syndrome. It really was a bad virus because it had a high case fatality of about approximately 10%, but it didn't spread as efficiently and all the cases were symptomatic, so that there was a recognition mechanism to kind of put people away to stop the spread. Then there was MERS, which was another newly emerging virus, equally severe, but it didn't seem to onwardly transmit significantly, although there was a cluster in South Korea. And then, of course, this one. All the previous coronaviruses were really just seasonal human common cold coronaviruses.
So really at the early stages, they look pretty much of a muchness. You've got cryptic information about clusters of cases somewhere overseas, and you don't know enough to really assess what the outcome will be, but you're getting prepared for the possibility that there might be returnees to Australia that you have to test. So that's really the focus.
Were there other SARS genomes available to compare it with?
Yeah, not SARS-CoV-2. So there was only the single sequence that was posted by Eddie Holmes and Dr. Zhang on the 11th. So SARS-1 sequences, yeah, sure, they're readily available, but no, there was only the single SARS-2, what became SARS-2.
There were other bat-borne SARS-like viruses, other coronaviruses. Obviously, since the emergence of SARS-1, there's been a bit more focus in as a zoonotic potential for animal-human transmission. So there'd been quite a lot of collection of various viruses that had that type of potential, and some were similar, and you've probably commonly heard the Chinese coronavirus that is equally closely linked to this virus, or the closest link to this virus.
So when you looked at the genome, was there something that made you go, uh-oh, this is going to be worse?
No, impossible to say at that point. That would be nice, and that's an interest of mine, I guess, is kind of risk assessing viruses off sequence. Could we do that? At the moment, we can't. So you really wait for information about what's going on in the public health arena.
So how long did the process of isolation take from say, the whenever you've got your first sample, how long did it take to isolate the virus?
Obviously, in that instant, it depends on the virus. Some viruses grow readily and some very slowly. So it's completely dependent on that and the cell line, perhaps, that you grow it in. So on that particular evening, on that Friday the 24th, our cells are always arranged to be the best on a Friday. So by chance, they came in, that sample was here when the cells were perfect. And so we had one hit at it. In this instance, we had a sample, one volume of the sample, and it was not a strong sample in this instance. It was not strongly positive. So the element to try in that context is to boost your chances by inoculating or adding a lot of the patient sample to the culture, which runs its own risks. But we had about a mil of the sample, and a good half of that, 600 microliters or so, went into the culture as our one chance to try and grow it. Luckily for us, it did grow, and we saw the first evidence of that potentially on the Sunday. I came in and had a look, thought that something might be happening because you assess it generally visually, and we took a little sample of fluid from the culture to test in our normal diagnostic PCR test, and it was a little bit stronger than it had been from the patient. So that's highly suggestive that it was growing, but really not definitive because there could be other things happening. So at that point, we put the flask of culture onto a little mini microscope that takes a little photograph every 15 minutes and assembles those photos to a video file, and we could watch that from our phones. And so indeed we did, and the next morning it was very clear that something was happening, and I texted Mike and said, look, it definitely looks like it's growing. I think we need to let WHO know.
I'm chatting today with Mike Catton, Julian Druce and Leon Daly from the Doherty Institute about their MDA National Prize-winning work isolating and sharing SARS-CoV-2, the first to do it outside China and the first to share their findings around the world. Their research is available at mja.com.au, where it is, of course, free to access. The MJA would like to very much thank MDA National for their continued sponsorship of the Prize for Excellence in Medical Research, which honours the best researchers in the country. Back to our chat with the Doherty team. What did that feel like? How does it feel? Is it a celebration type feeling?
It was sort of exciting, but it's kind of, we've grown lots of unusual viruses before. So it was kind of, we knew that it wasn't yet in the hands of too many people. We knew the Chinese had grown it, but we hadn't heard of any other teams growing it at that point.
Maybe Julian's more laid back than I was. I was pretty excited that we'd grown it. I think, as he says, we knew the Chinese had grown it, but we weren't aware that anyone else had. And we only diagnosed this guy on Friday night. And, you know, the lab had sequenced the sample through Friday night till 2 a.m. that night, and this is only the Sunday and we've grown the virus. So yeah. I thought it was pretty good.
And how long did it take you then to decide to share it and then get it out there?
Oh, Julian texted me right that same discussion. We were talking about it on the Sunday by text, and he suggested it then, and we agreed on the spot that that's the right thing that should be done. That was informed by our experience with SARS and bird flu and how challenging it was to get access to the real thing. And I guess the intervening years have only made that more challenging. So we thought that the right thing to do here was to share the virus widely, partly because of how hard it was to get access to it. There was nothing coming out of China, and we thought we were the first. And we thought that would strike, you know, send the right message about how this should be approached.
Are you able to measure the impact of the work you did in that period?
It's really hard to quantify. You know, in thinking about this work recently, we've thought about trying to look and quantify the impact of what we did. It's certainly true, and Julian would have had many personal contacts as well. There have certainly been people that have thanked us and credited us with making an impact on the work. But I think we can generally assume both that there was an impact on the science, and I think the message it sent was also not an insignificant thing. And we were blown away by the impact in terms of media interest that it was more significant than we'd appreciated.
Yeah, much, much more. We thought it would probably be a national story. And in fact, by chance, the ABC had been arranged a week before to come in and film on the Tuesday morning after the long weekend. And of course, by chance, that weekend was the weekend. And so they were actually in the lab filming us when we had the absolutely definitive verification that the isolate, the virus was growing by the output from the readout after 4 days. Was kind of exciting. And that news story didn't go ahead that night. So we thought, oh, well, it's not that big a news story, clearly. So the next morning it was released on the internet or the radio, I think. And it was from there that it expanded around the world. And I have a friend at the ABC, and they said it's actually the biggest news story the ABC's ever had. It was only then that we realized this is bigger than Ben-Hur, you know, it's just huge.
How does the Delta variant figure into your thinking these days? Is that what you're focusing on, or are you looking further ahead?
I think the answer's both. Delta has changed or updated many of the learnings we'd had about how the virus behaves how you use the public health tools that we've got to intervene while we try and get vaccine uptake up to levels that are going to be adequate to protect the community. So it has changed the game. The virus, at least while there are susceptible people in the world, and there's quite a lot of them, it will continue to circulate. And so Delta won't be its last word. And so I think we have to look ahead to other variants. Hopefully it's losing its wriggle room in terms of how transmissible and lethal it could get, because it'll pay a cost for changes. But I think we have to be, everybody else in the space are looking ahead to that possibility.
Does looking at the dominant variant now give you clues about where it might go?
Possibly. I have to emphasise, you know, we're not researchers as our primary focus. We're public health people, so we've got a lot of things that we're doing and focusing on, and that's certainly of interest to us, but it's not our main focus. But as I said at the outset of the conversation, I would love to have the capability to be looking at the sequence that you can get quite quickly and being able to predict virus behaviour from that. And the state of the art isn't there at the moment. We've got baby steps along that route, but no, it'd be lovely, but we can't.
On the sequence front, though, maybe include Leon here, as you could ask the question about the sequencing of the genome of the virus, because Leon was, he obviously did it from the isolate that we grew, but he was also the first with another collaborator to do it from the patient sample.
So I did just want to add onto Mike's comment there that I think SARS-CoV-2 will probably be a very good learning experience to try and develop these computational models to predict where viruses may or may not mutate. And I think I had a conversation with Julian about a year ago saying this is the first time really that we've had such optics on a pandemic worldwide that we are sequencing so many things. And a lot of it is people jumping at shadows. Any little change, everyone jumps on it, and the virus is taking this pathway of mutation and evolution. And really, it's the first time that we are looking at everything with such scrutiny. So obviously, influenza didn't have this scrutiny when it first emerged, and we now have many different types around the world. And I think this is really the first time that we are able to actually watch something from almost its inception and where it goes. Really a good opportunity for learning.
So Julian mentioned then that this was the first time you'd managed to isolate it from a patient sample. How hard was that to do?
I guess it was fortuitous timing, one could say. In December 2019, we actually had a visitor out from Wisconsin in the US. And so my interest is obviously in whole genome sequencing, but also the niche part of that of metagenomics, which is trying to find things or looking for the unknown. And so generally these days with the way that the equipment, the instruments work, if you know what you're looking for, it's very simple to sequence that pathogen or sequence what it is that you know. Sequencing the unknowns is much more difficult because you don't know what you're looking for, especially when it comes to viruses. There's very little genetic material from a viral sample and even a viral culture to sequence directly. You need to amplify it somehow. But with all the techniques that we have these days, you kind of need to know what you're looking for in order to amplify it. Working up something in December 2019 with this collaborator to try and have this non-specific amplification. So you just amplify everything that's there, and so all the unknowns are amplified. 1 month later, of course, here's SARS-CoV-2. And at that stage, there was no worldwide sequencing platform available for SARS. And so really, we ran it through this system it's known as CISPR for short, to amplify this unknown genome at the time. And we were able to get a hit there. It was further along. Once we knew what the genome looked like, we were able to refine and target SARS. And so that's one of the methods we use to go directly from patient sample, but also we utilize this CISPR technique as well, directly from clinical sample. But the problem being there is that because it amplifies everything, you also amplify other pathogens or material there. So it's a little bit trickier, but I think we were the first in the world, we believe, to have gone directly from a clinical specimen.
And how did that feel?
I was actually excited because a lot of it is you're crossing the fingers and crossing the toes and you're just hoping that it would work. And I have a research background and I do know that 90% of the things that you try generally don't work the first time, and you persist and persist and eventually you get over the line. And this, it just seemed like everything had aligned and we had beautiful sequence, which of course was then another sharing. So we shared that actually globally, so people could train their sequencing systems and models on what to look for with regards to SARS-CoV-2. So even that sequence was shared and was utilized early on so that people knew what to look for and could train their computers to search for it.
Mike, you said that Delta isn't necessarily your main focus. What is your main focus right now?
Look, at the moment, it's really working on tools, novel approaches to testing to help in the public health response. So ways of working on antibody tests to tease apart people's antibody responses, teasing apart antibodies from vaccine and antibodies from virus infection. And so questions like that, looking at niche applications for some novel tests, novel technologies for diagnosis as we come out of this phase of COVID zero into an open society again, where we're maybe tolerating a bit of viral spread. And we need to have tools adapted for that in the lab that can deal with that. So there's a whole raft of things that we're working on as projects. Look, I was in thinking about this award and the work recently, I just came to think it wasn't a bad month's work, actually. I mean, I know the viral culture is the headline news, but in those days and the weeks sort of around following on from Australia Day weekend, we diagnosed the first case and we were helping other states and other countries in our region by providing testing. We grew the virus within days from that sample, got electron microscopic images of it. So Jason Roberts, our electron microscopist who isn't here, got those great images that are in the MJA paper. Leon and George sequenced the virus, so the first whole viral genome. And in another bit of related work, came up with our collaborators at Monash, came up with a candidate antiviral. Now I know there's a lot of controversy around ivermectin. I won't go into that here. Whether or not that ultimately proves to be a success, it was a pretty good few weeks' work for the team. I'm just doing all those things. And of course, we've gone on to develop the saliva technology that's used in the Australian Open and in the quarantine hotels and approaches to pooling of samples to leverage more test capacity out of the test capacity that we've got and some of the really? Projects that I was talking to you about. So, you know, it's an interesting field, never a dull moment.
Have you guys had any sleep in the last 18 months?
Not much.
No, that's the one thing that's lacking. We've pretty much been here ever since. We have the weekends. Well, Mike and myself have weekends off, but they're peppered with phone calls.
Oh, yeah. But,
Leon and the crew in the lab, they're working 6 days a week, and it's usually 12 hours a day.
The lab's running 7 days a week.
But yeah, of course.
Look,
yeah.
So figuring out how to sleep standing up is our next project. That it's a team event, and you're talking to three people here. Of course, there are collaborators elsewhere in Doherty and our clinical colleagues at Monash and at Royal Melbourne. So there's a whole team represented by us at this moment.
I really appreciate your time. Congratulations again, and hopefully the $10,000 will help Leon have a weekend off or something. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.